Now, how would you like to proceed? What I could do, which let me make a suggestion. If you like, I think I might be useful for me to sort of start by giving you sort of the background of what in a sense was involved before FGO was set up. That is to say, what the setting was like at the university and some of the issues that were involved. That might give an additional background. Would that be helpful?
Great yes. Idea.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Eventually, we want to cover sort of a couple things.
Right.
The origins of the faculty grievance procedure and your time in relationship to it and the FGOs while you're president.
Right.
And then
right.
The second sort of topic area was the activity, the attempt to unionize the tenure system faculty and the two elections during your time as president.
Right.
So starting with what you suggested with the pre-FGO era is wonderful.
Great. Okay. And the other thing is, I take it, are you taping me or what?
Yes, we're at the Voice Library of the university in the fourth floor, and they are taping you.
Okay. And then I would like you to send me the drafts before and when we finish it, just because that way I can review it. Sometimes I swear when I read what I say, I said to myself, good God, did I say that? It wasn't exactly what I wanted to say. But anyway.
It's very understandable. It may take us a little while because there's...
That's okay.
The Voice Library has no transcription service built in.
Yeah, good,
so we'll
good,
have to... Good. There are a couple possibilities at the university for where we can try to get that done.
That's great. Okay. Okay, well, let me get started. First, let me say that... I'd like to sort of make mention of just the general setting there in higher education generally at the time in the 1970s. As you know, I mean, I was elected in 69 and became there in January of 1970. And, of course, it was a period of tremendous trauma and tension in higher education and change. And it was a kind of change which was the result of several different forces. You had not only the war and all of that entail, but also the characteristics of the university itself were under assault in different ways. One of them, which I think sometimes people are not fully aware of, is that there was a very interesting change that was taking place in the approaches and characteristics of the presidencies. That is to say, the leaders of the universities. This is particularly true. I'm sorry, my throat was caught. This is particularly true of those who were from public universities. At the time when I went to Michigan State, the typical president of the big universities, particularly the land grant universities in the Midwest, had leadership which was, I would say, not in a derogatory sense, but autocratic. You had very dominant presidents who, in a sense, ruled the roost. They were ones like Hannah, but you had others. They had people in each of the Indiana, Michigan, and then also in Minnesota, Wisconsin. All of them were people who were very strong in terms of their leadership. But that model was not working well in terms of facing up to the new challenges that were underway in the higher education system. And this meant that, I'm sorry, my voice is really going on. This meant that I came into the situation where the others who were there were on the way out, whether it was Fred Hovde or the others around there in the system. In the universities, they were people who had been there presidency for many, many years. Hannah was there for many, many years, but he ruled it. He really ruled the roost.
Mm-hmm.
But there were political issues. There were also internal issues within the universities in terms of the governance participation and the faculty participation in governance. All of those were issues that were impacting the universities. And so the institutions were in flux. They were changing. Now, one of the one of the things which I did, I approached, in retrospect, I realized, I approached the university as a living institution. That's a, I was much more concerned throughout my time there with the issue of the people, not only the people who were faculty, but administrators, but also the students. And the fact that the institution is really the people, the living, breathing entity, which really affects what happens within the confines of the university. And then what happened was that, by the way, one of the things that is very might be useful for you is that there was a program that was held there at Michigan State, and I don't know if you remember this, but it was they celebrated the 40th anniversary of Dolores and my having been at Michigan State, and it was held at the Wharton Center, and they had a panel as part of the program. There was a lunch and then a panel, and then they had a program in the dinner and then a program in the evening. But the panel in the afternoon was chaired by Jim Spaniolo, and it included Roger Wilkinson, Carl Taylor, painter.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Yeah. and they, Jim Bonin was there, and then also the painter who was the chairman of the department. Anyway, but the point I'm making is that that video, I have that and I can send it to you. But
that'd
but
be wonderful.
One of the reasons I mentioned this is one of the people who, for me, had been particularly instrumental in making me conscious, aware of the importance of the changes taking place and what were the issues that were involved, was Jim Bonin. At that time, Jim had a major grant to look at the future of the land-grant universities.
Uh-huh.
And he was engaged in research on that. And during the presentation that afternoon, there's a section in there where he talks about the change from Hannah to me and what was involved.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of the best things you could find in terms of that particular period.
Okay. This was done in 2010?
I'm trying to remember when it was.
About that.
I can look it up. But it was I swear they say in the morning.
Well, you said 40th anniversary of your being hired.
Yeah, I think that's what the date was.
So
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, give or take, around 2010.
Yeah,
that would be interesting to look at that.
Yeah, because he also was instrumental in working with me on that series of speeches I gave on the pluralistic university. If you remember, that was, you may or may not, but at that time, I decided that the way to lay out what I saw conceptually as the future of the public universities was a pluralistic university. And I gave three speeches, which were all interlocked. And the person who worked with me on those was Jim Bonin.
Okay.
So you can get a sense of what was involved.
Sure. Thanks.
Now, next is this, that when I move to the question of MSU in particular, what I found when I got there was that there were a number of initiatives underway which were important. For example, the initiatives with regard to discrimination were underway, had been done with a committee, if you remember. And they led to the anti-discrimination committee and also the judicial board. And I pushed that along. And as a matter of fact, you may or may not remember, but when I brought it up, it was one of my first board meetings with the MSU Board of Trustees, and it created a real storm. I mean, there were some trustees that were not in favor of this and so on, and I was able to finesse it and push it forward to the next meeting in order to work them in between to be able to get it done. But again, that was an attempt to deal with what was an emerging issue,
uh-huh.
which was relatively new for leadership in the university.
Mm-hmm.
There were other problems, the issues of how to deal with student riots. There also was a very strong push by the faculty over their lack of involvement in the governance of the university.
Uh-huh.
Not the issues which relate to their particular skills and sort of delegated areas of the faculty's academic certain. It was a question of, particularly, it was related to the budget.
Uh-huh.
They felt that they were not being consulted, they were not being involved, and that was a very strong feeling when I began working there at the university. So the issue of faculty governance was very, very critical. There was also the question of transparency. Hannah, God bless him, Hannah was fantastic, but he very often didn't necessarily share with everybody what he wanted to do or why he wanted to do it. He'd just go ahead and do it, you know, and announce it, and it'd get done, and everybody was happy because everything was getting well done. But here was a situation where people say, well, I don't know why you're doing this or what this is involved in, and I need to participate. So that was a very strong element. I'll come back to that because it relates to the question about unionization. But that was another issue.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had questions with regard to student participation. If you remember, we were going through the shift from single-sex dorms to dorms where you had liquor or not liquor. I mean, it was really all of those. And then we had the whole issue about the vote and the voting of age of vote. You had all of that in sort of trauma. And then because of the war, the students were organizing in terms of the war, and that created a body of students who were activists in terms of their impact on the university.
Uh-huh.
So there I was trying to deal with all of these newly emerging issues that were affecting the operation, the running, and the functioning of the university. And that was background for it. Now, in connection with this, one of the things is that some of these issues were individual and some of them were collective. In other words, let me give you an example. On the faculty side, one of the things that was involved was very often individuals had complaints. They had problems. But they also, the students had problems. All right, so the students had problems, so what did we do? We had the ombudsman, and that was a relatively new approach for dealing with their issues individually. But then with the faculty, the question was, how do you deal with them collectively? And I can go into that if you like. But what happened in terms of my approach, each time I tried to develop structures that would enable the response to be effective and also to be responsive. For example, with the students, what I did was I created a student advisory group, which is mentioned in my book, mm-hmm. on their participation annually with regard to our budget proposals. So at first, one of the members, an editor of the State News, and the first time I put him on there, he said, I can't be on that. That affects my objectivity in terms of the reporting. And I said, no. I said, look, you're always complaining about the fact you don't know what's going on. I said, this is a way to find out. Well, he finally participated. But the effect of that was to give the students an outlet where they could be seen to be and be directly involved. It made a huge difference. And I did the same thing with regard to the Academic Council. You may or may not remember this, but before I came, John Hannah hardly ever chaired the Academic Council. I felt that it was important that I be the chairman of the Academic Council regularly.
Okay.
Again, this enabled me to effectuate the impact of my involvement relating to issues that deal with the academics and also deal with the faculty. So all of those were elements of what is the background to the question of the faculty grievance officer.
Okay.
Now, on that one, I must admit, I do not remember. I know that the ombudsman was the first one in the country. The FGO, which came, I think it was in 1972, I don't know whether that was something that had existed elsewhere in higher education or not. I really don't. Maybe you do. Do you know that or not?
Our impression is that that particular model, if you look at the graduate research universities, is, if not unique, is very unusual.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think its formulation was something which we're interested in who worked on all of that, but that was a kind of new initiative at MSU and may still be today. We're gathering information on what other schools are doing. But
that would be good to do, because I think the thing is, it came right at the same time, as you point out in one of your questions, when there was this move for the faculty unionization. The faculty unionization was just simmering when I got there. It was not in full gear up, as it were. The groups that were involved, the AAUP and so on, they were sort of in the background with expressing their concerns, but it was not major. And quite interestingly, my support for the initiative of having the FGO was not related to, in any way, counter the faculty union movement or the collective bargaining movement. The same thing is true of the other things. In other words, I was making these changes in terms of how we shared the budget with the faculty, or how we shared the budget with the students, or all of that was done because I felt that it was good governance for the university in that modern era of that period. It was not because I said, oh, this is going to stop the union move or the collective bargaining movement. It really was not. I was very conscious of the fact that I wanted to have Michigan State, never mind about other places, I wanted to have Michigan State responsive to the needs of that institution and the people in that institution. And so that's why I created so many of these things. Now, with the when this happened, of course, the end result was that all of the things that I had done when the movement for collective bargaining came up, it was really, in retrospect, very funny, because they were able to get the signatures to have the vote, but the faculty created the committee, as you know, which went around and said to everybody, I said, I will live with faculty unions if you said it, but I want it to be a vote where the majority of the participants and the majority of the university actually vote. I don't want it to be 20% of the faculty or 30%. I want it to be at least more than 50%. I want it to be a big vote that makes it clear what the faculty really want. Now, the interesting thing for me is that when the vote came in 1972, it absolutely swamped the faculty, the collective bargaining groups. And the result was that many of the faculties that came up to me afterwards and said, we don't need the union because you have done all the things we needed to have done without going through faculty union. And that pleased me a great deal. Now, as you point out, I think the second vote on the union came back soon after I left, just as I was leaving. And that one was defeated again. And both times, the organizing groups for the unions, they could not understand why they lost. I mean, and the thing was, as far as I was concerned, was it wasn't because I didn't say a word of being anti-union. I wasn't. Because, you know, at SUNY I work with the union. But it's just that I went there and I found the areas of need, and I responded to those areas of need with a structure which was distinctive and which was positive and transparent, and everybody had the opportunity to be participating in it. So it was nothing underhanded about it at all. It was not anticipatory at all. I wasn't doing it to say, oh boy, in the future this is going to stop a union. No, I didn't do that. I was worried about how to be the best possible president for the university that would be helpful by doing these things and making it successful. So that sort of is where I came out on it. So that's my whole preliminary statement about the issue. So go ahead, any questions at all?
I have several that I could ask in relationship to that. So I could do some research, but I didn't yet. Were there statements that you made in newspapers, whether it was the city paper or university paper, where you were asked by a reporter, what's your position about this unionization effort, and you said anything similar to what you just told us?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. As a matter matter of fact, the committee went all over the campus. It was a faculty committee, and they made it clear that I said I'm not against unions. I really wasn't, and I said I will live with whatever the decision is. I mean, it's there. If you can find it, I don't know whether you can find it in the newspaper. It was there, though, no question about it. And I have it in my book. You'll see some of it in my book. But it was there. I mean, I didn't have to.
So the votes are, all three votes are fairly similar, this one I don't have it right in front of me, but I think it's 63% to 37%. 37%.
Which one are you talking? Which one are you talking about?
The first one, the 72, October 72.
I don't know. Let me see.
So they're all in the range of about 60% opposing a bargaining unit and about 40% in favor.
Yeah.
They vary just by a percent or two, but I believe this first one is what I just said, 63 to 37.
Let me see.
I think
I have it in my book. Let me just see.
Well, I have the numbers. We were just at the archives yesterday.
Yeah, yeah.
So I believe I just quoted that correctly.
No, more than 80% turned out.
Yes.
It was 72%, yeah.
Yeah, the 1,931 voted, which is a very high percent.
Yeah,
1,213 said no agent, which is 63% of the voters.
Right,
and 37% chose one of the two. 438 was the MEA and 280 was the AUP.
Right.
And the next two elections are somewhat similar, so.
Yeah, well, I was only there for the, also, I guess, the 78 one, I think. I was either there or I had just left.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then the third one's 82.
There's an interesting quote in a document, a memorandum I think you shared with John Cantlin after the first election, saying, in effect, what you just said, we've been working on a variety of things and we need to be responsive, but there is not zero and there's a not insignificant number of people, not a majority to be sure, who are interested in unions. And so there are issues that we've got to continue to deal with. And that was a kind of a very distinctive, reflective comment after the election. Which was, you know, we won, quote, and we don't have to worry about it. And you said, no, we've done things and we got to continue to move ahead. So that's consistent with what you said earlier, I think.
Right.
So if I can ask another question related to the unionization effort, first one.
Sure, go ahead.
So Doug Nova recently wrote a book on the time period, including your years, and he has two pages about this issue. And he spent some of those two pages about the election of October 72 by prefacing it that some of the issue for some of the faculty thinking about unionizing was, like you say, a lack of input about salary or salaries being low or benefits not being good or good enough to retain senior faculty, that sort of thing, and there were some state appropriations problems apparently in 71, 72 that were fairly significant. He also makes comments about labor industrial relations professor Repus and trustee Claire White releasing the salaries, and that tied into this, and I wondered if you had any comments about that.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, I'm laughing, I know, but I shouldn't, but the point is that Bob Repus was I will describe him as a major outlier in terms of representing anything within the university. That's just a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
And Claire White, as you may or may not know, was one of the three people who voted against me to be president.
I didn't know that.
Yes, and secondly, when he released the faculty salary, well, what happened was he believed that before the salaries became public, Claire White always voted against any member, any salary which was higher than his salary as a math teacher in the high school there in Michigan.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, and he would never vote for anybody who had a higher salary than he did. And then he was the one who, at the board meeting, during one of the sessions dealing with the salaries, every board member had a book of the salaries, and the press was in the room, but they could not, they were not supposed to share it with him. He turned around and handed the book to the Lansing State Journal reporters, and then it was print, the whole book was printed in the Lansing State Journal the next day with the names and all the rest of it. There were some humorous events that proceeded from that because, for example, many members of the medical school had neighbors come over to them and said they had care packages because they really weren't getting very high salaries than they thought they were. I mean, it was some people really kind of laugh at all of this. Now,
uh-huh.
They were angry that they released it. But even there, what had happened was I had created a subgroup of the board to work with us on getting a process for releasing the salaries. I didn't say I wasn't opposed to it. I was opposed to having it done without knowing what you were doing and how to do it. And I did that, and even though it became public after that, it also was done as a result of eventually of what I had done to set up this informal group to discuss how to make that release, and then we did. So it was, but that one was, that was one of those little things that I have to explain. For the whole time that the troika, as I refer to them, it was Warren Huff and Claire White. The three of them were Democrats.
Who's the third?
They voted against my appointment.
Nesbitt.
And who? I'm sorry.
I think Steve Nesbitt was the third.
No. I'm trying to remember his name.
Don Stevens.
Three Democrats. Nesbitt was a Republican.
Don Stevens.
No. He was voted for me. He was a Democrat.
Yeah.
The two Democrats were Don Stevens and. Good.
We can look it up. That's okay. Doesn't matter.
No. He's a football player. Blanche Martin. Okay.
Oh, okay. Martin.
Yeah. But the three Democrats, the other Democrats, led by Claire, by Warren Huff, they voted against me on everything. After every board meeting, they did everything they could to get rid of me. And you'll see in my book that I met with all of when I was incoming as president, I met with each of the board members separately and discussed with them what did they see are the major issues that I needed to deal with.
Uh-huh.
This is before I ever moved. The three of them would not meet with me separately. They met with me together.
Gotcha.
And they met with me in a motel near Flint, and let me tell you, it was an hour and a half. I have never had a group of men curse me the way they did.
Hmm.
They accused me of having engineered this whole election, the whole thing. And then they said to me, don't unpack because there's another vote coming up in November, and we're going to see to it that you're gone. I tell you. And so then I said, I'm going to do the best job I can. And they said, I lose, period. And I left.
What do you think drove those three to be so opposed to you so completely?
They wanted to mount Soapy Williams as a president.
Okay.
Plus, there were personal things as well. I mean, I don't want to go into it, but
that's okay.
I know what Huff wanted to achieve. Claire White was another thing, but it was a situation where everybody on campus knew what was going on, and I had to be very careful whenever I brought something up. Be sure that I had the votes.
Gotcha.
Every board meeting, every month, I had to be sure I had the votes. And every once in a while, there'd be some trick that they would try to pull on me. And, because I chaired the meeting, I was able to see through what they were doing, and I would be able to block it. But it was, as long as they were on the board, they were my adversaries, okay? So that's just by way of background.
But it wasn't purely political because Stevens was a strong Democrat, but he supported you.
That's right. Oh yeah, no, it wasn't. It was political only in the sense that the Huff wanted the the former Soapy Williams to be elected because he felt that he could use Soapy's machine for his purposes. That's another issue I won't go
Okay,
into.
Fine, thank you.
But it's a very, it was a, let me put it this way, it was an interesting experience in terms of local state politics, I got to tell you that. But they eventually outlasted all of them. And it was, but that's another issue.
That's helpful, thank you.
Yeah.
So was your time here always that difficult, or was that just the first couple of years?
What you were describing. Now that's not a fair question in the sense that.
Okay.
No, let me explain. I could find out exactly what years they left, but the board always had a certain level of fractionalization.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sometimes a political one, but oftentimes it was idiosyncratic.
Gotcha.
But it was in my book, I talk about it a great deal in terms of what they were like and so on. I had some great supporters on the board, both Republicans and Democrats. I mean, you know, but they're also, you know, the thing was there were people who had their own agendas and wanted to do things. We had a student of trustee who really was off the charts, and I mean, who voted? He was elected and voted, and boy, the governor finally persuaded him to resign because he was really doing things that were just out of the purpose. So it was a very difficult one.
Thank you.
They were hard, some of them, but actually, I was able to deal with them quite effectively, I must say. And as a matter of fact, inside in the university, it became well known that if I brought something before the board, I was going to win it every time.
Okay. Can I, one more going back on something?
Sure.
You said that you weren't opposed to a release of salaries if it was done in a sensible way, and you helped create a committee or worked with a committee to look into that issue.
Yeah.
Was that something many other either land grant or public universities were also dealing with or had released salaries?
The issue of salary disclosures was a movement taking place then, I know.
Okay.
But how many did it at that time, I don't know.
Okay, but we weren't the first in any way.
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't know.
That's fine. Curious.
It wasn't a committee that I created. It was something internal, administratively.
Gotcha. Okay.
And we got it then. Yeah.
So, do you want to say more in terms of the elections, or we switch to the grievance procedure?
And it's which elections?
The union elections.
Union. No. It's
okay.
How should I put this? One of the things which I think is a central issue in all of this frequently is the need for the leadership to recognize what are the critical areas of major responsibility for faculty.
Uh-huh.
And that one is one that I always recognize, and because I had been a faculty member myself, so it was something that I knew about. And that, as a result, when I spoke to the faculty groups, they knew that I knew what I was talking about because I'd been one of them. Yeah.
So just a little tiny aside. Sorry, I didn't come here till 77. So Bob was here, but I wasn't during much of your time. How were your relations with the other unions, the non-faculty unions, in those years?
Fine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, there was a union, which was it? Oh, excuse me. There was a, was it the theater? I don't remember, Bob. There was a theater union. People worked in the theater.
Which would be very small.
Yeah, it was very small. And it was, actually, that, it was handled very, very well. And very, and
uh-huh.
Actually, I guess it was Bob, not Bob, Jack Bresnan handled it.
Uh-huh.
See, the thing, just to give you by way of background, when I went to SUNY with the 64 campuses, all of the state-operated campuses were union. Unionized, the whole thing was unionized. And the union negotiations were conducted by the state.
Uh-huh.
I just sat in on the side. I mean, you know, dealing with it was, I did not have an aversion to unions. I really didn't. And that became very clear. But I wanted to know, do you want what I have developed for you, or do you want to use the union? Okay. They all said, no, we want what you did. That was very clear.
So we want to switch to the grievance procedure?
Yeah.
The grievance.
Now, I have little insight into what happened. In other words, I don't think I can remember ever getting a report. I may have gotten reports, but I'm talking about a particular problem that came to my attention. I may have, but I just don't. I don't remember them because I think the people who took over were very good. I think the first one who was there, he was extremely good, Mike Harrison. So it was, I think they did their job, and it was very well done, so I didn't have any feeling of that.
Well, one of the interesting questions for the grievance procedure is its form and character, which, as I alluded to earlier, is somewhat, if not unique, relatively unique in higher education. It's not a normal grievance procedure that follows a collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
And there was a body, a mixture of some faculty and administrators that developed a procedure, and that committee had a title which was essentially the committee to deal with faculty rights, responsibilities,
right,
and the development of a grievance procedure.
Right.
And I was wondering whether you had any sense of how that committee was created, because it was not a university committee on faculty affairs committee. It was a body, as I've described, a mixture of administrators. John is looking for the document. You will remember all
which one you're talking about.
All the names.
Well, what happened? I think there was a faculty member. Oh God, what was his name? Who was very much involved. He chaired it.
Well, and Fred Carlisle was the chair
of
this
body.
Yeah,
right. It was Fred, and he chaired it. Now that had started before I got there.
Uh huh.
So I couldn't tell you why he did it the way he did or what he did. But that was not that happened before I got there. I mean, the beginning of it started then. And then it was the format was developed and then presented to me and to the board. But I wasn't there when they were putting it together.
So just to recall history, Fred was the chair, Vera Borisage, a faculty member, Herman King was on it, Madison Coons.
Oh, Herman, he would be the... Go ahead.
Yeah, Jerry Miller... Bill
Jerry
Sweetland,
Frank.
John Waite, Sandra Warden, Freddie Williams, and Rita Zemack. And then there were people listed as former members, Harold Hart, Virginia Malman, and Chitra Smith. So there was a mix of faculty.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, I would say of that group, at least two-thirds or three-fourths of them were the kind of people whom I used to refer to as the quiet leaders, that is to say, they were people who had tremendous standing among their fellow faculty members and great trust from them. And that group, when you got them doing something, the faculty as a whole would say, they're going to be good. And I could tell you, I mean, I knew who they were. And Fred Williams, for example, give you an example. When I had the problem with football, okay, I had to create a group to help me work to investigate the allegations made by the NCAA. Guess who one of the people was I put on? Fred Williams. I mean, you know, I knew who these were. And they were in that committee, I'll tell you. And that's why it went through so well.
Okay. So that's interesting. The other related question is the actual document that was developed and still remains largely in place today. There have been modifications and adjustments over the years. A document that I would describe of having a process that is somewhat like a grievance procedure under a union contract, in which ultimately there are hearings. The distinctive feature is the administrator, whether it's the provost or the president, is the final decision maker, but there'd be faculty panels and so on. And then a very elaborate process for the holding of hearings and the selection of members and ground rules and so on. So it was partly a collective bargaining origin, but also a very legalistic document.
Right.
And one wonders how that was put together. Some people have said Lee Carr wrote it. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But Lee Carr never leaves any messages, any notes behind, so it's hard to track that.
No, he wouldn't.
Yeah.
I think, I really don't know. I really can't answer that. I think I would have to guess. I really would.
What would you guess?
It's just that the thing is that if Lee were asked a question, a legal question, he would give you his best answer. You're right. He would not have very little put down on paper. So I don't know whether he was involved or not, or how. I really don't.
So we interviewed one of our other colleagues who you would have known well. Bob, I'm just blanking on the name. Keith Grody.
Oh, Keith Grody, yeah.
And
Keith
said he didn't write it.
Yeah.
But he had...
Keith.
Keith Grody said he didn't write it because he wouldn't have written something that legalistic.
Right, exactly. No, he didn't.
He wondered whether or not it came as a model like from the Central Michigan University, which had just recently had a grievance procedure and a contract made. Somebody else, Phil Korth, who was a union activist, is the one who suggested maybe Lee Carr wrote it. And we didn't know if there was a model from some other university or.
I honestly don't know.
That's all right. It was a curiosity. Because to labor relations people, it looks very much like a union contract, except the final step is internal in that it's the provost and president, not an arbitrator.
Right. I don't know. I never even heard of it. But
anyways, this committee clearly had involvement because it's their recommendation you that says here's October 1st, 71. They actually give it off to something called the administrative group, based on Cantlin had been involved. And then there's subsequent drafts that go through. And then, as you said yourself, it then ends up with Michael Harrison as the first FGO, he does it for a year.
I tell you what, go through the names of who the group were again. Let me see. There may be some coming in. You had Fred Williams. Who else? You had Chitra.
Hold on.
Just a minute. He's getting the...
I just have to open the page up again. So the chair says Fred Carlisle.
Right.
Vera...
Let me just ask, on Fred Carlisle, he worked with you. He went to be provost down at Miami of Ohio, and then I think he went to VPI. Is he still around? He was probably retired.
I don't know. It might be worthwhile trying to find him.
Yeah. Because I think he seemed to be at the administrative center of all
and
this
he
stuff.
And he was, at that time, he was one of the really very great leaders there. Go ahead. Who else? Yeah. Fred, and who else was there?
Second name is Vera Borsage.
Yeah, I know Vera, yeah.
Herman King.
Now,
Herman King is the person who ran all of the commencements. And he had a commencement book, the like of which you've never seen in any other university, on what to do and how to do it. He was a very meticulous individual. He was not legalistic, though, I don't think. But he was a detailed man. If you ever wanted something done and wanted it done absolutely to the letter, the way it was supposed to be done, Herman King would do it. Okay, go ahead. Who else?
Madison Kuhn.
Oh, historian. Yeah, he's very good. Now, Madison's not legalistic, but go ahead.
Gerald Miller.
Jerry was one of the leaders in the review when we were preparing for the vote on the union. Go ahead.
William Sweetland.
Yeah, I didn't know him that well. Yeah, go ahead.
John Waite, W-A-I-T-E.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sandra Warden.
Yeah.
Fred Williams.
Yeah, of course, Fred is a historian, yeah.
And Rita Zemac.
Yeah.
And then it says, as Bob mentioned, former members, Harold Hart.
Yeah, he was good.
Virginia.
Harold, I'm trying to think. Was Harold, they had been legalistic. But
Virginia Malman and Chitra, C-H-I-T-R-A, Smith.
Yeah, Chitra, yeah, she's a pistol, yeah. She might still be alive.
She is.
Yeah. You might talk to her. The thing is this. She's a person who might be able to tell you a good deal about it, even though she's just listed as separately. But see, Fred Williams, I know, is dead.
Yeah.
And the others are. But I think Chitra, if she's still alive, I would try to talk to her.
Anyways, the group's called the Ad Hoc Committee to study faculty rights, responsibilities, and grievance procedures.
Right.
And they were given an original charge from the steering committee in October of 1970.
The
ad hoc committee was then appointed with reps from major standing university committees, academic council, and the provost office, met for the first time in January 71.
Yeah.
Began studying a full range of concerns, rights, responsibilities, and grievance procedures. And in April, they temporarily suspended work on rights and responsibilities to concentrate on grievance procedures.
Right.
So, anyways, we were just curious if you knew any more in terms of that. Grody did not. The couple of union people we've interviewed did not. So.
Yeah, okay.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So, so you said you didn't have a lot of interaction with the FGOs because they basically did their job. Was that what you said earlier?
Exactly. Yeah. And very often, if they reported back up, they would go up the chain of command. If they reported to the provost with John Cantlin, he would take care of it and wouldn't even get to me. Yeah. So it's really very. It was. Let me put it this way. It was both there and in the ombudsman. It was very rare that I would be notified about something. Once in a while I would, but not always, you know.
So were you, is your sense that it was a fairly healthy, useful, effective procedure?
Oh yeah. I mean, it was very, very much so, yeah.
Did anybody from any other universities that weren't union ever, as far as, did you know that they contacted MSU curious about this?
They didn't contact me, that's for sure.
Okay.
No, I don't remember. Yeah.
Was there more publicity about the ombud system as something unique than the grievance procedure for faculty?
I don't know about publicity. I think the ombudsman, because it really dealt primarily with students, may have, from time to time, would have something, but not really. The one that got, every once in a while, would be the anti-discrimination one. We had a big flap at the board meeting one time about that, and I think I talk about that in my book. But that one got attention just because of the nature of it, and the fact that the dissident, the troika, who opposing on the board, very often would pick something out of there and try to make a problem for me.
Okay.
They never succeeded, but they tried.
Are there other questions about either the unionization attempts here or about the grievance procedure we're failing to ask you about?
No, not that I know of. I think the major thing is that the fact that it continued and did so apparently with no major issues or problems of operation is really quite good. I mean, it's when you stop and think about it, it's I'm not going to make a comparison with the current situation on anti-discrimination Title 12, but I think the structures that we put in place at that time, whether it was the Judicial Board or the Anti-Discrimination Committee or the FGO, the other, all of those were very, very well run, and they were very, very good. And, you know, it was really quite a testament to the people who created them, how they did it and so on.
So I have a little different question. In the more recent years, and we've trying to cover that period too with others, the provost and presidents have more involvement with what's a much larger general counsel office and attorneys on different kinds of cases.
Yeah.
You didn't have that.
No, no. And I think probably because the tendency towards being litigation has grown nationally.
Uh-huh.
That is to say, there's a more litigious situation. And there was cases like that, but nothing major. I mean, I had, for example, I had two lawsuits against me on tenure in SUNY. I didn't have any at Michigan State. No, it was just a different era. There's more of the we'll sue you, or, you know, kind of thing. But I don't know whether that would be appropriate or not, but it didn't happen there. You know.
And pretty much as I understood it, you had Lee Carr on retainer, sort of, and he was the advisor.
Let me tell you, Lee Carr was the only lawyer for Michigan State for I don't know how many years. We had a hard time getting him to bring in a full-time lawyer. I mean, it was really, this is just between us. He was so damn good, but he would not want anybody else coming in.
Uh-huh.
And we finally, it got to be too much for him, and we finally were able to do it. But he was a unique person. I mean, he was just fabulous. I don't know how many times he was there to provide the legal counsel, and he had his own regular job too. I mean, I don't know how he did it.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to talk about Lash?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Well, now what happened with Lash? Well, do you know who he is or how he is?
Oh yeah,
I knew him very well. I interviewed him about being FGO years ago.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Yeah, long ago.
Well, it's going to be interesting because Lash, he saw himself as a great gadfly. And all these pro-student, pro-faculty, and against administration and governance. I mean, I was in his column almost every other week while I was there. And most of the time, I'd look at it and say, oh, there he goes again, you know. But hardly ever, anything vicious. I think only once did he make out one, which was about our son Bruce. But otherwise, he was not that kind of person. Now, so I guess it was when Mike retired.
No, it's
Bruce.
Or Bruce Miller.
You go to Miller and then Lash.
Yeah, right. And so when Bruce left, I said, I really got to get somebody who'd be a good FGO. And I thought about it. I said to Al Ballard, who was my assistant. I said, Al, I said, what do you think about my trying to get Lash through? He said, no. I said, well, think about it. So he did. We talked about it. I said, look, I think he would be a very good choice. So he finally said, oh, well, go ahead. So I had him come in. Well, I have to tell you, in the book I described this, that I said to him, I said, I need to have you, I want to appoint you as faculty grievance officer. He said, no. I said, no, you better do it. I said, I want you to do it. I said, you've been pro-faculty all your life. I said, you are known as an independent person. You're not a shill for the president or any of the provost. I said, you would be ideal for this. No. He goes on. So then I said, I tell you, Lash, if you don't do this, I'm going to make it public that you turned it down. And he finally looked at me, and he said, damn. He said, okay, I'll do it. And he did. And he was funny as hell. But he was good. You know, I knew he was good. But the other part of the Lash LaRue story, which this doesn't fit into the FGO, years later, on a visit to Michigan State, he had retired, and I went out of the Kellogg Center into the parking area of the Kellogg.
Uh-huh.
And as I walked out that door, suddenly a Rolls Royce comes driving up and stops right in front of me at the door. And out pops Lash LaRue. Here he is driving a Rolls Royce. And Lash says, "President Wharton." I said, "Hey, well, hi, Lash. How are you?" He said, came over, shook my hand. He said, "I want to thank you." He said, "You said you were a great president." I said, "Thanks a lot." And he laughed, and then he took off. I mean, this was Lash LaRue. He was
right.
That kind of personality. Yeah.
I had the privilege of. I did a lot of Michigan labor history work.
Yeah.
And Lash would have me come in once a year to give a lecture.
Right.
And then in 91, my wife and I moved from Lansing to East Lansing, and we bought Ralph Smuckler's house.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And so we were close to Lash's house, so I used to visit him regularly on Gunson.
Yeah.
Well, he was a great character, wonderful man.
He was. And as I say, I don't think he was not a mean person.
No.
And so it was just his role. He loved to play it, so, you know.
No,
but he was good. He was good. Yeah.
The view of many deans and others said, well, he's just going to be a faculty advocate, and you're not going to get any fair and clear sort of deliberation of matters. But I work with him closely in my role in the provost office, and I agree with just what you've said, although my view originally was more skeptical about Lash. But he was tough. He would tell a faculty member, you know, you have a right to file a grievance, but I'm going to tell you, you're going to lose because you don't have a basis for it. And I suggest you go home and work harder, and you'll get a higher raise. But don't come and waste everyone's time with a committee hearing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, that is exactly. I mean, I thought that he would be like that. I really did. But it was, you know, just a matter of judgment of his character. So I
don't know if you realize I was the FGO for 8 years.
Yes, I know.
And I would never have phrased it like Bob said Lash phrased it.
Yeah.
But I would have been a little more subtle.
Yeah.
By the way, one thing that you may or may not want to do, one thing that occurred to me was there's a question in doing this review whether it would be helpful to perhaps have some examples of some of the most unusual cases or some of the most difficult cases or the most successful cases. I think that the average reader, even a faculty member who has not participated in it, in the process, really would not have a good sense of what's involved in the FGO's work. And having some examples, it doesn't have to be many, but just a few examples of successes or failures or outstanding difficult ones, it would be, I think, helpful to the average reader. That's just a mild suggestion.
That's a very, very helpful. Starting with Mike Rubner, who was the FGO beginning in 89, through my time, and we think the next couple, we started having more regular categories of what kind of grievances, which ones were about reappointment, which is promotion, which is tenure, what's on different issues, salary stuff. And so we will be able to present some charts that show this percent of cases were handled this way. And one of the things that's fascinating is for all the years that I've compiled so far, the average is only 3.5 hearings a year. Everything else is handled without a hearing for whatever reason. So,
that's amazing.
So we'll be able to say some things about that.
Good. Very good. Yeah.
So if you have anything else to share with us, otherwise we can thank you very much for this opportunity.
I hope it's been helpful. I don't know, as I say this, there's some parts of memory that work and some parts that don't.
Yeah. Well, so I don't know. I think Bob told you that we're going to be interviewing John Cantlin next week.
Oh, wonderful. No, good.
And so
give him my regards.
We'll do that. And some of what you said will be very helpful for asking John some questions.
Good. Now, and I will send you this video, and
that'd be very helpful.
Yeah,
we can make
okay.
a copy and then send it back to you.
No, you keep it. No,
okay. And I haven't started reading your book yet, but I've purchased it, so I'm looking forward to reading it.
Well, you might find it some interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
And so I just want to thank you very much for being part of this. You will get this release form. We will get some kind of transcript to you also somehow. But it might not be for a couple of days or weeks.
That's all right. That's
good.
Okay.
Thanks for your time.
Good
appreciate
luck.
It.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.